This is The Guardian.
Today, could China ever invade Taiwan? And what would happen next? For most of the past 2 years, as a deadly virus has spread across the world, the island of Taiwan has been an oasis, pretty much COVID-free, with life mostly normal. Schools open, busy markets, parades. But there's another side to the place. Helen Davidson, a Guardian correspondent based in the capital, Taipei, has been writing about it.
I've been working on a series of stories about China's military modernization and its aggression towards Taiwan. In the process of doing that, the name of Admiral Lee Shi-min kept on coming up. He is the former Deputy Defense Minister of Taiwan. He was also head of the naval force for several decades. He'd recently retired just in the last couple of years. And so I went and met him in the sort of the cafe lobby of his own apartment block just outside of Taipei.
Yes, okay. So I'll start the recording on that one. Okay. But if there's anything you don't...
Over the past few years, China has stepped up its claims to Taiwan and sent hundreds of warplanes into the skies around the island to intimidate its more than 23 million citizens. October saw a record number of aircraft breach Taiwan's air defence zone, and Joe Biden asked whether he would intervene in any conflict. Tensions are the highest they've been for decades. It's got Taiwan's military establishment, people like the Admiral, thinking more about a scenario that's long felt unlikely, too frightening to imagine, but not impossible.
So during the interview, I asked him what is kind of a scary question, but one that really goes to the heart of what's going on here. I wanted to know what the first day of a possible invasion or an attack by China looks like for people in Taiwan.
I know this is very hypothetical, but in the event that China, that the PLA did decide to invade Taiwan, can you tell me what that first day looks like?
But if it really was to take over the political control for the Taiwan, you need to send your ground troop to be in Taiwan. Before doing that, you have to control the air and sea power.
The scenario that the Admiral described was horrific. There's sort of no really other way to describe it. What he talked about involves a lot of bloodshed. It's incredibly violent.
Lots of missile attacks, long-range missile attacks, air attack, cyber attack, to complete paralyzed, damaged your main battle force.
Mm-hmm. He said the first day of an attempt to take Taiwan is going to involve a lot of missiles, airstrikes targeting key assets around the island. I mean, the thing that really surprised me about this was he said this so sort of calmly, matter-of-factly, as though it was something that they know they can't stop, that if this is what China decides to do, then this is what's going to happen. I'm just imagining this, you know, this horrific event where unannounced missiles are hitting Taiwan from China, and they are, you know, they're exploding communications towers. They are taking out naval bases and army bases. And a lot of these places are very close to population centers. There is just this horrible, chaotic disaster.
As the rivalry between the US and China has grown over the past years, no place has become more dangerous than the skies and seas around Taiwan, a democratically governed island that China says is part of its territory and will be returned to its control by any means necessary. But how far is it really willing to go? From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, why is China threatening Taiwan? Helen Davidson, you're a correspondent in Taipei with The Guardian, and you've been covering the recent escalation in tensions with Beijing over Taiwan's future. You've told us a bit about what's at stake here, but is there something that sticks in your mind as an image of what it's like to actually live in these circumstances?
So on the 10th of October, on a very, very hot day, I covered the formal ceremony and the parade for Taiwan's de facto National Day outside the presidential palace in Taipei.
中华民国生日快乐!
台湾 National Day 2021!
It was a very joyful atmosphere and people were very happy to be there. It was smaller than usual as far as crowds go because of COVID restrictions. But for the actual ceremony itself, like, it was big. It was showcasing everything about Taiwan, what it means to be Taiwan, which means it was pretty mixed and at times pretty confusing. So we saw, you know, we saw musical performances and martial arts demonstrations. We had school groups doing gymnastics. We had a bunch of teenagers dancing TikTok songs, like kids flossing in front of some highly decorated generals was perhaps one of the most Taiwanese things that I've ever seen. And then following that, you know, we had this very elaborate parade, which included the Olympic team, COVID responders, you know, members of the Coast Guard, topless firemen. I'm still not sure why they were topless. And so it was this very sort of joyful and celebratory parade. But then the last half of it, or perhaps even more than half of it, was just tons and tons of weaponry. So we're talking like the military tanks came through, these enormous military diggers, and then you had these trucks carrying huge missiles. This parade of heavy machinery and heavy weaponry, everything in camo and soldiers marching in formation. That following the festivities that had come earlier, it just seemed to encapsulate this image that Taiwan is sending out to the world. You know, this idea that we're a super fun democracy, we care for each other and we love dancing and we love colour, but also don't mess with us because we've got some really big guns and we will use them to defend ourselves.
Those feel like images from a country with a very complicated history. Can you tell me a little bit about how Taiwan got to that point?
In a very, very short and inadequate summary of the history of Taiwan and how it got here, the island of Taiwan was and remains home to Indigenous peoples, but it has also been colonised by several different parties. So China's Qing Dynasty held it for about 200 years before ceding it to Japan in the late 1800s. After World War II, when Japan was defeated, it was handed back to what was then the Republic of China. Now, inside the Republic of China, there was a civil war.
October 1st, 1949. In Beiping, Mao Zedong inaugurates the so-called Chinese People's Republic. The communist victory, celebrated with a display of captured American arms, has been won in the face of what, 2 years before, seemed insurmountable obstacles.
Which it saw the Communist Party defeat the Republic of China, or the ROC government, who were the nationalists, and they then retreated to the island of Taiwan.
In December 1949, Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist government flee to the independent island of Formosa, 100 miles from the China mainland. Here Chiang waits, vowing to return. The future remains uncertain.
So from then on, Taiwan's own history saw decades of brutal authoritarian rule under Chiang Kai-shek and his son before transitioning into democracy in the late 1980s. And so if you fast forward to now, Taiwan is sort of one of the world's top economies. It's a very strong example of democracy. It's pretty progressive. So it was the first government in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage, for example. So it's been a very complicated history.
I mean, yeah, there's colonization, civil war, dictatorship, and now vibrant democracy. Look, I realize this might sound like a stupid question, but is Taiwan an independent country?
It depends who you ask. So if you ask China, absolutely not. Taiwan is a province of China that must be returned by force if necessary. If you ask Taiwan, so Taiwan's current leader, Tsai Ing-wen, who's been democratically elected twice now and is very popular, has a very careful formulation for how she describes Taiwan. For China, a declaration of independence is a red line that Taiwan cannot cross. For Tsai, she doesn't need to cross that red line because she says Taiwan is already independent.
So Helen, if I have this right, Taiwan doesn't want to declare independence because that would anger China, but says it doesn't need to declare independence because it's already independent. And that slightly absurd word game might be one of the things preventing a war in East Asia.
That's it. Yep. Semantics is keeping us in peace for now.
Okay. Okay. So China clearly very fiercely believes that Taiwan is a part of its country and they're much bigger. They have a huge army. Couldn't they just go and take it?
So there's another really significant player here, and that's the US. Since the 1970s, the US has recognized Beijing as the Chinese government, and it hasn't recognized Taiwan, but it has very strong ties and strong commitments to Taiwan, including ensuring that it is defendable, if not defended by the US, that it is at least defendable against Chinese aggression. So, I mean, we saw that way back in 1996.
For people in Taiwan, this is their proudest moment.
Taiwan held its first presidential elections.
As the leading candidate, Lee Teng-hui, likes to say, these are the first free elections of a Chinese leader in 5,000 years. This is the new rough-and-tumble world of politics in Taiwan. In their parliament, clashes of ideas sometimes become clashes with fists.
In response, China holds a missile test.
Here, the views toward Taiwan's election remain equally unyielding. The Chinese missile tests and military exercises have sent a blunt message across the strait. Taiwanese independence is not an option. China will use force if necessary to stop it.
The U.S. sent a nuclear warship to the region.
With two U.S. naval battle groups now in the South China Sea, the war of nerves intensified.
China backed off.
That was 25 years ago. It was a very different world. What's happened since in China?
So over the last 25 years, China has massively expanded its military. It's increased the number of troops. It has hugely modernized the assets that it has and the infrastructure that it has on the mainland. We've seen build up and expansion of bases along the coast and along border areas. I mean, in the last 25 years, it has become a global world power and it is seeking an even bigger role in the world now.
So in 2013, Xi Jinping comes to power and he seems to have an even more aggressive attitude towards Taiwan. How has he changed Beijing's approach?
Xi is a fiercely nationalistic person. He is also very sort of expansionist in the way that he operates China's regional policies. So Xi has made it a key part of his own legacy to reunify Taiwan into China. It's part of what he calls his China dream, part of the great rejuvenation of China. And for him, retaking Taiwan or annexing Taiwan is a key non-negotiable part of that. Without Taiwan, he cannot rejuvenate the nation as he has pledged. People have made entire careers out of passing the various words that Xi uses in speeches to try and, you know, to try and gauge what he's thinking and what's motivating him. But what we do know is that he is seeking a very unprecedented third term as leader of the Chinese Communist Party, and Taiwan has become part of his promise of success.
Okay, and what has that done to the region? Like, how have tensions escalated recently as a result of all of that?
The People's Liberation Army, the PLA Air Force, is sending warplanes into Taiwan's air defense zone on a near daily basis for the last 2 years. This escalated earlier this month. So in the first 4 days of October this year, they sent 150 planes, including nuclear-capable bombers, including stealth jets. Every time this happens, Taiwan scrambles its own air force in response. What this does, I mean, from a purely strategic point of view, these PLA flights both serve to intimidate Taiwan and to literally wear out its planes. Every time Taiwan has to send its planes up, it's wearing them out a little bit more. So it's serving to, you know, exhaust the other party before a war has even started. Now, with this escalation of all these what are called gray zone tactics, we're now seeing other nations get involved. And so Japan is now speaking out much more vocally. Japan's defense minister told me that he sees Taiwan as an increasingly important issue and that other countries around the world really need to stand up together to push back on China's aggression. We're seeing a huge increase in the number of exercises by US and European and Australian and New Zealand ships and other military assets. And so we're seeing this massive escalation in tension and presence and just sort of almost a standoff in this region now. Taiwan's defense minister described it very recently as the most tense period it's been in more than 40 years. I mean, there is no doubt that what is happening right now is an incredibly dangerous and worrying situation.
Helen, what you're describing is a pretty small bit of sea and airspace that's now absolutely crowded with military hardware from powerful states across the world. That seems like a really precarious state of affairs, like an awful lot could go wrong there.
One of the most likely scenarios for a conflict, according to many analysts, is actually an escalation of one of these activities going wrong, essentially an accident happening, and it escalating to such a point that we end up in an all-out conflict. Now, something like this has happened before. In the 1990s, a US and Chinese plane actually collided in midair, but that was de-escalated essentially through communication. And one thing that a lot of analysts and military figures tell me is that communications right now, particularly between China and Taiwan and China and the US, is at such an appallingly low level at the moment that they do fear that they won't be able to de-escalate a situation in time like they were able to back in the 90s.
I remember an Economist article earlier this year that called Taiwan the most dangerous place in the world. How does that sound to ordinary people living in Taipei?
Yeah, I mean, like, so a lot of people laughed at that headline because when it came out, everyone in Taiwan was kind of like enjoying a COVID-free life and pretty happy about things. So the idea that it was the most dangerous place in the world sort of felt really laughable. But they did have a point. There was a kernel of truth in it, because if a conflict escalates from Taiwan, it will inevitably involve so many countries from this region and from elsewhere around the world.
I've been looking at predictions of when a Chinese invasion might take place, and they range from a few decades away to others, including from the Taiwanese defense minister, who says we might only be like 4 or 5 years away from this kind of scenario, which is horrific to imagine. Even with US help, Taiwan would still be facing the world's biggest army in China. According to Brookings, the Chinese military has something like 2 million active personnel. How could Taiwan defend itself against an army that large?
So one of the other main points that Admiral Lee made when he was talking about what the first day looks like was that while Taiwan might not be able to stop an all-out air assault on the island, if China's main goal is for an actual takeover, they need to have troops on the ground. Now, Taiwan itself is geographically very difficult to invade. There are, I think, about a dozen beaches that are actually suitable for landing on. It's a country of cliff sides, essentially. And that's where Taiwan can defend itself, in stopping actual troops getting on the ground and taking political control of Taiwan. But there is a lot of concern about the actual readiness of Taiwan's army, and also the readiness of its people. So I've also written about programs running here, hoping to expand training up local people on how to respond to a disaster or a conflict actually on the ground.
What kinds of skills are they taught? I mean, what skills do you need to fight back against the Chinese invasion?
So a lot of the skills that are being taught in these programs are focused around first aid. And the first aid skills are really focused around sort of like wartime injuries. So essentially they are being taught how to stop the person next to them bleeding to death. It's a pretty extreme thought that they're being presented with, but it's also one that makes sense, because if there is an attack, or indeed even if there's a natural disaster like an earthquake, it's incredibly likely that first responders and other sort of established aspects of authority and assistance are going to be paralyzed or at least very, very busy. And so it's going to be up to you to look after yourself or the people next to you.
That's an incredible reality to be trying to live with every day. What you're talking about here is a land, sea, and air war between the world's two most powerful nuclear-armed nations, maybe drawing in American allies in Asia, in Europe, with the risk of escalating into a full-blown nuclear conflict. Let me put it this way. Can you tell me anything that might help me sleep at night?
Sure. Look, what I can say to that is, As horrific as these scenarios sound, they are not considered the most likely scenario by any real serious analyst in this picture. There is also a lot of focus on what many analysts think is more likely to be used, and that's things like misinformation campaigns, cyber attacks, political influence or destabilization. And so while we've spent a lot of time talking about the prospect of missiles and bombings and escalations into a multi-party nuclear war, the focus is on keeping the peace. Taiwan wants to maintain the status quo as it is right now. The current government has no interest in declaring independence. It just wants to continue living as it does. It would very much like to be a part of the UN and recognized by more governments around the world, but it is perfectly happy maintaining the status quo. The reason there are so many parties involved now is to try and dampen that aggression that China is displaying and to try and convince China that it's not worth trying anything. The stakes are too high to try anything, and so let's just keep things as they are.
Coming up, if China were to launch an attack on Taiwan, what would Joe Biden do? A lot of this status quo that we have currently seems premised on the idea that the US would definitely come in to help if Taiwan were to be invaded. But how certain are we that Joe Biden or some future American president would commit America to that kind of war?
That's another very difficult question to answer, because the US's policy is entirely predicated on refusing to answer that question. The US doesn't actually guarantee whether it would come to Taiwan's aid militarily if China attacked. So this is under like a 40-plus-year-old policy called strategic ambiguity, which it maintains in order to deter both sides. So deter China from attacking and deter Taiwan from perhaps crossing that red line and declaring independence. We recently saw Joe Biden make some off-the-cuff remarks in a town hall that the US was indeed committed to defending Taiwan.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that.
The White House walked back those remarks, but at the same time, there is a strong sense that it was sending the message that the US will help. I think there is increasing confidence that the US would step in. But in the same token, I mean, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs really made hay with what happened in Afghanistan. They used that disaster of an exit to turn around to Taiwan and say, this is who you're relying on. You know, why? You know, the US is not going to come to your aid. And if it does, it's going to do a terrible job. So whether or not they would is a very difficult question to answer. I mean, there are a lot of analysts who will say that if they didn't, it would be a huge blow to their credibility as a world power.
Helen, we've been talking about this in terms of big world powers, but at the center of it are 24 million people actually living on these islands. What is it like for Taiwanese people to live their lives in the shadow of these kinds of apocalyptic scenarios?
I went out into Taipei the other week to sort of gauge how people were feeling about it, you know, amid all these PLA flights over the Taiwan Strait and all this extra activity, how they're actually feeling about it themselves. And usually older people don't want to talk too much. You know, they're quite reticent about speaking politics, especially to strangers and especially to media. And a big part of that is because they grew up under authoritarian rule, under martial law, where such thing was very, very harshly punished. But in this one instance, I went into a park. There were a group of older women and some of them had been doing their morning exercises, doing fan dances under the shade of the tree, and others were sort of just sitting by their bicycles chatting to each other about the day. And we went up to them and we asked,
what does it mean for you to be from Taiwan?
What does it mean for you to be from Taiwan? And one woman immediately launched into politics.
So she started to talk about politics already.
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay.
And she started talking about how tensions are very high, but people should be calm and they should not argue too much.
So this lady, she said, we should keep the gentle opinion to avoid the fight, avoid the argument.
which was then sort of ironically interrupted by her friend, who sort of leant over a bicycle and started shouting, you know, Taiwan is independent, we're an independent country, we're not China's.
This lady say, Taiwan is an independent country, and she has been living there here for 70 years, and it's her country, and it's not possible, belongs to China.
And it sort of sparked this debate between these old women in the park. On one side, you know, you had these very vocal, I mean, essentially pro-independence women defending Taiwan, very angry at China's aggression. And on the other side, you had this much more quietly spoken woman who, I guess, sort of felt the same way, but at the same time didn't want to rock the boat. So I think there is as much a feeling of defiance in Taiwan as there is a feeling of, yes, we are independent, but can we just not rock the boat? Can we just be calm, not antagonize China, not talk about it too much? Let's just try and keep existing quietly and maybe no one will bother us. And I don't know if that tactic is going to work anymore. I think we've seen China show that it sort of doesn't need provocation anymore.
So this is something that people are definitely talking about in the streets, but beyond it, I mean, is life in Taiwan just continuing the way that it always has?
This is the thing. Despite the threat, life is still going on pretty much as normal. Taiwan has been under the threat of a Chinese invasion or an attack for decades. So a lot of people just don't worry about it. It sounds really strange, and concern about it is increasing, but a lot of people will say that there's no point worrying about it every day because it's just like worrying about an earthquake. And, you know, we get a lot of earthquakes in Taiwan. This is, you know, to really stretch the metaphor, but like pretty regularly the ground shakes for a bit and then people just get on with their day. And at the same time, pretty regularly the PLA sends a bunch of jets across the strait and people still just get on with their day.
Helen Davidson, thanks very much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
That was Helen Davidson in Taipei. Thanks very much to her. If you haven't already, go and subscribe to Science Weekly, The Guardian's dedicated science and environment podcast, which is going daily from Glasgow all throughout COP26 to bring you what you need to know about the past 24 hours at the most important climate summit ever held. You can search for it and subscribe wherever you get this podcast. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We're back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.